This is Inside Open Wheel with your host, Jeremy Scott.
From the TrackOn Multimedia Studios, just southwest of Chicago, this is Inside Open Wheel. Hello, everybody. I'm Jeremy Scott. A busy show for you today. First off, we're going to talk about the developing news later on in the show. That is that the Mid-Ohio rounds of the NTT IndyCar Series have been postponed. Nick Yeoman, our IndyCar insider, will be joining us here in just a little while. But before that, there's a new announcer in town, and trust me, he's actually really, really good. It's Eric Brennan of FanRacing.live. We're going to talk at 4FR Americas. Get to go through what the schedule holds for the 2020 season, the remainder of the schedule, and what's going to happen now that the U.S. Grand Prix has been postponed. Either way, you can tweet us at Inside Open Wheel on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. And it's by searching Inside Open Wheel. Also, you can leave us a voicemail at 815-714-9260. Also, drop us a line on our email, insideopenwheel@gmail.com. So, a busy week in racing. And yes, I said week because you had USF 2000 and Indy Pro 2000 at Mid-Ohio on Wednesday and Thursday. Race one for both series was held on Wednesday. USF 2000 was won by Christian Rasmussen. Eduardo Barrichello finished second. Reese Gold third. And Indy Pro 2000, Braden Eaves, Daniel Frost, and Parker Thompson were your podium finishers. Now, race two in the USF 2000 was won by Rasmussen. Reese Gold second. Nolan Siegel was third. Artem Petrov, DeFrancesco, and Stingray Robb, your podium in Indy Pro 2000. Race three immediately held after those other two races. Christian Rasmussen takes out a clean sweep, so he, like Linus Lundqvist, continuing on his winning streak. Well, we're going to find out, though, if he did so in FR Americas here shortly. Christian Rasmussen, Dior Lando, and Gold, your top three in USF 2000. Stingray Robb gets his first win of his Indy Pro 2000 career. Hunter McElroy and DeFrancesco, your top three in Indy Pro 2000. Their races are also postponed as well. Their doubleheader at the Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course. So when we have more information for you on that, we'll pass it along. We'll also try and get the Road to Indy insider, Rob Howden, on the show. Now, over at Barber Motorsports Park, F4FR America has shared the track with my friends over at the Radical Cup Series. Hunter Yaney went in the first race of the weekend in F4. It was a quadruple header because the F4 cars had to make up one of the races at Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course. And Eric Brennan is going to tell us about what happened there and the rules behind that. Hunter Yaney wins the first race of the weekend for F4. Sam Paley second. Kay McKee third. Jose Blanco takes the second win of the weekend. Win of the day, I should say, for F4, Sam Paley, and Spike Kohlbecker round out your podium there. In between those two races, FR Americas was on the track for their first race of the weekend. Linus Lundqvist, Victor Franzoni, Dave Malukas taking the podium. Each series had two more races on Sunday, with Spike Kohlbecker taking his first win in a close finish between he and Hunter Yaney. Might even be the closest finish in F4 history. We'll find that out a little bit later on. Maybe even a little bit later on in the season. I might be able to do some homework here in the next couple of weeks. Hunter Yaney and Paley, your top three there. Hunter Yaney wins, bookends the weekend with wins by Kohlbecker and Jose Blanco. Finish the podium in F4. In FR Americas, Linus Lundqvist, Hayes, and Malukas, your podium finishers there. Third round, Lundqvist, Malukas, and Hayes round out your podium there. So Linus Lundqvist is 8-for-8 so far this season. And we're going to pose the question, is there any stopping Lundqvist this year? It's a very serious question that's being asked around the paddocks of FR Americas. We're going to find out more here with Eric Brennan just a little bit. Some other big news that popped up this weekend. Cole Purr, NASCAR Cup Series championship crew chief, I should say, won a title with Martin Truex Jr. He's got a crew chief, Connor Daly, for the Indianapolis 500. I'm going to talk about that with Nick Yeoman here in just a little while as well. So really, it's going to be a light weekend for racing, but I've got to say this. It's going to be nice to kind of take a break before we head into the month of August, per se, at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Next couple weeks, we're also going to have some Indy 500 previews. Going to try and get Mark James, the voice of the Indianapolis 500 from the IMS Radio Network, on board with us. Nick, as you know, is a pit reporter for IndyCar Radio and the IMS Radio Network, so we're going to try and get the both of them on at the same time. Next week, we're going to take a look at practice, going to preview the qualifying, see how that qualifying order differs from the past couple of years, and then that Monday after, going to do the big Indianapolis 500 preview. I'm really excited because the Indianapolis 500 is like Christmas morning for this announcer. Other than that, do want to let you know that F4 FR Americas are going to take a month and a half off. Their next round is at the end of September at Sebring International Raceway. Then they go that next weekend to the Homestead Miami Speedway for their next round. So back-to-back weekends in Florida for those two series. All right, coming up next, Eric Brennan makes his debut as F4 FR America's insider. He's with FanRacing.live, and he's next here on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Oh, we still have a lot to talk about with the cancellation of Mid-Ohio. We'll have more on that a little bit later on. Also, I got some special info from Jimmy Johnson's test at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Nobody's talking about it here except for Inside Open Wheel. Joining me now on the line is one of the commentators for FanRacing.live. We've been talking about them the past couple of episodes, how they've been having live coverage of F4 United States Championship, FR Americas. Eric Brennan joins us from FanRacing.live. Eric, I've got to say, as somebody who's been trying to get a network off the ground that has been wanting to cover more of the Junior Formula, Junior Racing Series, it's refreshing to see, and you guys are doing a great job with it.
And Jeremy, we really appreciate it. And I will say, as a relatively new listener to the podcast, I also want to say that you're doing a great job shining a spotlight on the sport. I learned a little bit more from your episode with Christian Bogle a couple of weeks back than what I was able to obtain at the racetrack. So I appreciate that more than I could tell you. But yeah, the network itself, the idea actually derived from a relationship that one of our directors, Ron Sperling, had with the World Karting Association. And he was actually able to meet a couple of the representatives from the F4 series who was on display at Daytona Kart Week a few years ago, and that kind of got things in motion to put this network in place. And I will say, compared to some of the other options that are available, not really for open wheel racing, but even on some of the pay-per-view stock car platforms that are available, they're throwing a lot at this, and hopefully the production quality is also kind of showing that and being able to display all of the work that is going into being able to cover some of these top tier road racing circuits in the country. And we're actually really pleased with where we are now. Mid-Ohio was a little bit of a learning curve for a number of reasons. The rain, of course, didn't help. VIR, we got a little bit better. And then everything was clicking on all cylinders this past weekend at Barber. And I'm very lucky to be a part of this team. And we have some top-notch sports professionals who are making sure that we could put these races on to not only put these drivers and teams in the series in the spotlight, but also just to provide more options for the true open-wheel enthusiasts.
Well, being somebody who has broadcasted live from Mid-Ohio, whether it's been from the PA booth or, you know, trackside, I understand the challenges of trying to broadcast something to Mid-Ohio because you're literally in the middle of Ohio, the closest town, yeah, maybe 3 miles away, but it is so tough to get stuff out there. And really, you guys did a great job with that and working with SVRA. But we're here to talk about the Barber Motorsports Park, and I did get a chance to watch Sunday's races because Saturday, as I told you off the air, I had some racing of my own to call, and it was a little damp, and we won't go into the GT Challenge over at Autobahn, how small that field was. But first time at Barber Motorsports Park, you guys shared the track with my friends over at Radical Cup. How was it working with those guys? Because they're a great group of guys over there in the Radical Cup paddock.
I will tell you, one of the best things, and I can compare it to Mid-Ohio, they had a really tight schedule at Mid-Ohio because we also had Trans Am there. There were a couple of vintage classes there as well, and I don't blame them because it was the first chance for a lot of those racers to get back to the racetrack after everything happened. Working with the Radical guys, though, I mean, it was kind of seamless, and probably one of the biggest things we're going to talk about is a decision that the series made in order to try to increase the likelihood of green flag racing. And the Radical Cup teams, they kind of like amended their schedule as well in favor of that. And the timeline flowed perfectly. We had one delay early in the morning on Sunday due to a crash in the Radical event, but they had built such a buffer in the way they structured the weekend schedule. It was perfect. And I will say, I got to walk around a lot of those vehicles. That was my first time seeing the Radical Cup cars up close and in person. And all of them, I mean, you want to talk about a group of individuals who are really out there to just have a good time. And they, too, are doing what they can to build their brand in that series. That is it. I mean, I know they're not necessarily open wheel, but there is a great group of guys. In fact, they had a big party and gathering where they catered food for a lot of their competitors and team owners at the end of the night. And we got to go over there and learn a little bit more about their series, their goals, their schedule, as I think they have Laguna Seca up next for them. But it was great, and a lot of the young drivers were also really interested because, you know, the pathway from F4, everybody wants to move up to Formula Regionals. It's also, you know, the F3 chassis that they're running there. They rebranded the series because the goal is taken outside of the continental United States and hopefully get into Canada or Mexico as time goes on. But a lot of them were looking over at these cars because, you know, you don't really know what direction your racing career is going to take. And I saw a lot of eyebrows raised by some of the young competitors is maybe that would be something they want to go in and play with. And in fact, I believe Jordan Missig also has some Radical Cup experience as well in the past. So it's unique to have us all there at the same time. And I think it just fits. It splits up the type of racing product and on-track product we see. And hopefully there'll be more of those conjunction events as they build the schedule in the coming years.
Yeah, Jordan actually came from the Radical Cup National Series, but also the regional one out here at the Audubon Country Club. And there's a good story about his first national weekend, too, that is for a later date. We talked about it a little bit in the interview with him. But, yeah, it's interesting to see that you have drivers who come into Formula Cars, and they're like, well, I want to go straight to IndyCar. I want to go to F1. And, you know, sometimes they end up going to, you know, like an IMSA, or they end up going to a World Challenge because, you know, there's not many IndyCar seats available compared to how many people are coming up through the ranks from karting into Formula Cars. So having Radical Cup there, it's a great springboard. And two, Radical Cup really got started a couple years ago in earnest here in the United States. It's big in Europe, but no, it's great to see that everybody was meshing along there. Great weekend for F4, though. Three different winners in four different races, and that fourth race was a makeup from Mid-Ohio with that wet fest that was there that first weekend.
Yeah, and if your listeners are not familiar with that situation, it was a wet mess. It's probably the best way to describe it. It literally started pouring as they were bringing the cars up to the grid for their first race on the weekend of two. And they allowed everybody to switch over to rain tires. They went off into turn number one, which, you know, very tricky, fast left-hander. And about, I'll say, maybe 5% of the field just couldn't hang on to it. It was a parking lot. And they quickly went full course caution. Prior to that, though, because of the tight schedule and having to work around Trans Am, the vintage cars as well, they had reduced the race to 15 minutes. So, I mean, you're talking 4 minutes for a lap under yellow. They were getting ready to restart after about two laps under caution, so we're at the halfway point of the now 15-minute race, and a car stalled on the back straightaway. And that just kind of put the kibosh on the race entirely. So it actually says in the SCCA rulebook that if a lap is not turned under green, they don't award championship points for the event. So they were kind of backed into a corner where they wanted to offer an opportunity to make up that race, and that's why we had four races on the card. And it was phenomenal. And some of the results that came from that, the following race that we had at Mid-Ohio, plus the three races we had at the Andy Scriver Memorial at VIR, just plagued with caution. So the series was able to build a one-hour umbrella, is the best way that I could describe it, over the 30-minute time limit event. And if a yellow flag did come out, and we actually saw this happen in the first race of the weekend. We got a couple of really early yellows in lap two, and then shortly after the restart the next time by. And they were quick to hit the red, stop the clock, allowed the drivers to come down on pit road. You know, they let one crew member go out with an umbrella to make sure that they weren't sitting there just sunbathing while wearing the fire suit and helmet and the whole nine. And it allowed us a chance to kind of thin the herd a little bit, stretch things out. And then we were able to see some really exciting racing. I mean, in that first race, we had probably about four cars jockeying for the top four spots in a three-lap shootout at the end. And it came down to a margin of victory of about 1/10 of a second with Hunter Yaney grabbing the win there. And in race two, that trend kind of continued. Wasn't as wasn't filled with as much yellows as what we thought, and it ended up being Jose Blanco who took top honors in that as well. And so that first day of competition, which I know that you had aforementioned announcing commitments, we really missed some good ones, but I think we made up for it in the latter portion of the day as well, though.
I was going to say, yeah, especially on Sunday with Spike Kohlbacker taking his first win. That was a fantastic race. I will admit, three to go, I thought that Kohlbacker was going to be taken by Yaney there in turn six. Didn't happen. Two to go, heading into the S's. I thought, well, maybe Yaney could do it on the outside. Didn't happen there either, but I'll say this. Yaney and Kohlbacker, I mean, even though Kohlbacker's a little bit further down in points, this is going to be a great battle here as we go into the final three rounds of the season.
And if you look at the personality of both of these drivers, they're kind of even. And when we came into this weekend, we were really keeping our eyes on Hunter Yaney and Dylan Tavella. And, you know, Tavella's a great story. I mean, young driver out of Long Island, New York, which, I mean, I was originally born and raised in New York City. So anytime that I hear of anybody that comes out of motorsports from that quadrant of the country, I'm interested. And actually on his website, it's ridewithdylan.com. He's got a great long form kind of storytelling complex to how he got to the race car, and he overcame a lot of personal obstacles to do so. And those were the ones who had five wins in five races heading into Barber. So we were keeping our eyes on them, and Tavella just kind of struggled a little bit. He was up towards the front at the early portion of the race. But you mentioned Yaney and Kohlbacker. These are two drivers who caught the attention of the officials a couple of times at VIR. In fact, they were assessed a couple of penalties, one for bumping another car into yellow, another one for, you know, avoidable contact. They're not afraid to throw it in there. So when we got to that last lap shootout on Sunday, and those were the two that were up front, and again, you know, Kohlbacker's representing the Kiwi Crosslink team. Yaney's driving for Velocity Racing Development, so there's no team affiliation between the two of them. They really were able to go for broke, and they also had a pretty good margin back to the third-place runner, who at the time was Sam Paley. So at that point, I'm with you. I'm thinking they're going to tangle at some point, especially when they got up to turn 12, because that's when desperation appeared to be setting in for Yaney, who, despite the championship lead, he has openly and publicly said that his objective is to collect trophies. He wants to go down as the most winningest driver in F4 history. If he could make that happen, and I got to go back and do my own research to see what exactly that mark is. But he was very dejected to finish second by 41 thousandths of a second, as Kohlbacker just did a phenomenal job as far as defensive driving. None of the moves that he made to try to defend that spot were even questioned as far as blocking or being a little bit too aggressive. He just hit his marks as perfect as possible, and Yaney came up about a half a car lane short. And as you mentioned, with all the diverse tracks that we have left to go, Sebring, Homestead, Circuit of the Americas still on the card as of right now, that is really going to test both of these young drivers, two American drivers, with Yaney out of Virginia and Kohlbacker out of St. Louis, Missouri. And this could be the beginning of a potential rivalry that doesn't just stay here in F4, but continues up the ladder.
And we'll talk about the schedule coming up here in just a little bit, as we are at the halfway point, and we still got to talk about FR Americas, but I do want to touch upon that, not only that defensive rule, but I want to talk more about this red flag situation that happened during the races, which I'm sure you saw as well on the Inside Open Wheel Twitter. I applauded the move because it was very smart, but the defensive move, it reminds me a lot of Tony Kottman's rule in Champ Car, where you hold your line and you stay there, no defensive moves. I actually know the person who came up with that rule back in when Car became Champ Car. And I've got to say, that has got to be one of the best defensive rules in all of motorsports.
Yeah, and I always hinged on the verbiage moving in reaction to, and I always felt like that, although it's a great way to define the blocking rule to somebody who's not too familiar with motorsports, I do feel it leaves a little bit of a gray area, almost like a ball and strike call. You know, what exactly is in reaction to, or what exactly is committing to your line, you know, later down the straightaway or with a quicker approach to the corner. And I agree with you. And I think they got a really good group that right now atop of these SCCA officiating standings and race control, with Scott Goodyear heading things up, Brian Till, former announcer as well, and racer himself is also in the mix. They got a lot of guys who really know the art of racecraft, and I think that's really what you need in a series like this, where experience is relatively low. I mean, we've got some drivers in the field who their first time ever competing in any form of professional motorsports is the Sports Car Club of America F4 United States Championship. And I mean, that's a big jump to make from not having any professional karting experience, or some of these guys come from, you know, lower tier sports car events. And I think the best way in order to hone these drivers into people that we want to see be able to entertain us years down the road on some of the bigger stages in racing, you got to have the guys in place who truly know what's going to happen. And fortunately, at least in my short tenure with the series and in the handful of races we've had and the three racetracks we've visited, we have not seen too much of that. We have not seen too aggressive of a move. We've just seen a lot of mistakes, truthfully, to bring out that yellow flag situation where the series had to react and try to make a change in order to ensure more green flag racing. And even in the latter stages, I mean, Hunter Yaney did get a reprimand for the last race of the weekend for making a couple of bob and weave moves. It's going to affect him on the starting grid when we get down to Sebring in about a month and a half's time. But we have not really seen the penalty for blocking come into fruition, at least not yet at this point in the season. And hopefully it's able to stay that way, because we know that the consequences of that could be catastrophic.
Indeed, yeah, and talking about that yellow flag rule, I think it was great that finally, you know, the series officials said, look, guys, if you can't get your act together, we're going to bring everybody in, clean up, so we have green flag racing, because it's not just a problem in F4, it's not just a problem in FR Americas. I'm noticing it in the road to Indy 2, where these drivers, whether because we've had a shorter season or because they're so used to doing iRacing, they're coming in and just thinking they can make moves they can't. Well, now we're down for 2-3 laps yellow, and that could be, you know, 5-10 minutes, depending on what course you're at.
And honestly, you bring up a great point, Jeremy. The unknown. I mean, right now, we have a question mark on our last race of the season. Now, the plan by the series is to be at Circuit of the Americas, if not to be somewhere else. But not really knowing how long that this series is going to go, also having to have waited another 2 months to get the series underway with all that's happening in the world right now, I think that's added a little bit more angst into the mind of some of these drivers. And it's kind of created a really, not trying to figure out the best term to use here, but it's created a lot of pent-up energy that the only place to unleash it is on the racetrack, and it's causing a lot of issues, as you mentioned, not just in F4, but pretty much everywhere in some of these lower series, or these feeder program series, I should say. And the other item, you know, the series wants to do what they can to allow these drivers to not only showcase their talents, but also to learn. And you really don't learn a lot when you're running behind a safety car for the majority of the race. So I think the move that they made, not only to improve the racing product, but also to try to allow these drivers the track time that they've signed up for, is a big deal. And you also brought up the iRacing portion of it. I mean, that is a forum. It entertained all of us for quite some time. Even myself, I've actually been doing some work with the World Karting Association in their series on Wednesday nights, just to kind of keep those drivers in the groove of competing in some element. But the lack of consequences, you know, it really may have a negative impact once you climb back into the race car. And I'm not sure if there's a correlation there. It seems to be a bit of a common denominator in some of what's going on. And maybe as the races went on this weekend, we saw the racing product improve. We went caution free in our last race at Barber. So, you know, I guess they just need a little more time to get acclimated to the cars and just kind of let some of that tension of the unknown kind of fade away just enough to improve the on-track product. And I hope it continues in that direction.
All right, Eric, we're going to take a quick break. Coming up next, we're going to talk some FR Americas, and we're going to continue on to this discussion on the at least the next two tracks that we know we're going to for sure, a little bit of COTA discussion and what else may happen. You're listening to Inside Open Wheel. The wait is over. Inside Open Wheel is now on Apple Podcasts. So no matter where you get your favorite podcast from, you can always get a new episode of Inside Open Wheel on that same program. Heck, you can even get a push notification right when we release new episodes. Once again, Inside Open Wheel, we're now on Apple Podcasts.
This is Inside Open Wheel with Jeremy Scott.
Continuing our conversation with Eric Brennan of FanRacing.live, we dove into F4, touched a little bit about the future schedule. We're going to talk more about that later on the segment, but I want to talk about FR Americas F3 for those who now are starting to learn the ladder a little bit. Eric, the 600-pound gorilla in the room, can anybody stop Linus Lundqvist?
At this point, I don't really think so. I mean, so even if he was to pull out of the series now, he would have already have the title as the driver who won half the races. You know, and I mean, we've literally gone 8 for 16, and he has been the only driver to win in any of the events that we've gone. And we already mentioned how diverse the schedule is, and it's only going to get a little bit more challenging as we go forward. But I'll tell you something interesting. Sports Car Club of America president Dan Hellman came over to us, and, you know, because we, you know, you start to hear whispers in the garage area, and the Global Racing Group, you know, they're always fast every year. If you go back and look at the standings, they've got a car that is up there competing for a championship annually. But you start to hear some of the teams and the drivers say, man, I don't know what he's doing differently. And even some of his teammates, my announcing partner, Craig Minervini, he had a sit down, a roundtable discussion with the other Global Racing Group drivers. And, you know, just to kind of see what the camaraderie was like. And although Benjamin Peterson went overseas, he wasn't there. But we still had the likes of, you know, Nikki Hayes, James Rowe, and trying to remember the other driver off the top of my head. But they were able to kind of bounce ideas off one another and just kind of talk about what the relationship is like internally. Dario Cangiolosi, I had to Google that one momentarily. So just to see, you know, is Lundqvist sharing his information, his data? Are they trying to feed off him? And as we all know in open wheel racing, I mean, you're typically judged by the performance of your teammates. I mean, that happens in Formula One. It happens in IndyCar. If you're able to see one team or one driver excel for one organization, the question is, why isn't everybody else? So for those three, you know, the pressure is exponentially high. Dan Hellman told me that they're starting to see signs of a young Scott Dixon in Linus Lundqvist in the way he approaches practice. And he says, if you watch him, and I will take fault in the fact that I have not done this yet, but now that Dan's mentioned this to me, that is my first objective when I get to Sebring. When Lundqvist unloads off the truck, he's typically one of the slowest in the running order. And apparently he seems to tackle each corner independently, usually starting from the slowest sector of the racetrack and then working his way up as far as trying to perfect sector and split times. And that is how he's able to put together and fabricate a quick enough lap time on the weekend. And then he just doesn't stop. He does it in qualifying. He does it in the first race, second race. If we have three, he'll do it there as well. And I think it is that approach. And for some, it sounds like some of the racing schools even try to teach and coach young drivers to have this attack on a new circuit, because Lundqvist is not only new to the series, he's new to the States. He only came to the United States like 3 weeks prior before our first race in Mid-Ohio. And two of those weeks, he had a quarantine due to COVID, you know, regulations. So this is phenomenal. And, you know, it's sometimes it's hard to recognize greatness when you're living in it. And I think it happens in all forms of sports. And I made this reference on the broadcast. You know, when you look back at the, if you're a baseball fan, like Craig Minervini, who works for the Marlins on Fox, it's his normal day job, my announcing partner. You look back at the run the Yankees had in the 90s and 2000s. You know, it got annoying after a while. But now when you look back on it, you see that nobody else has been able to replicate it. You admire it. Michael Schumacher's run with Ferrari, Jimmy Johnson's run where he won 5 championships in a row in NASCAR. Now, I know that the Formula Regional America Series is not the pinnacle of this level of motorsports, but this performance is out of this world. And Kevin Williams, the president of the World Karting Association, passed along the nugget that in USF 2000, Kyle Kirkwood once won 9 races in a row. And to his knowledge, he believes that is the longest streak. He went on to win more in that season, but as far as in consecutive order, that is the target which Lundqvist is going to try to tie the first time he gets on the track at Sebring. And I think it is fully possible for him to run a table at this point.
Yeah, and that's going to be an interesting point to see if that happens, because Sebring, it's not difficult from a track layout standpoint. It's difficult from a track surface standpoint, because you're going between two different surfaces, from, you know, just your normal everyday tarmac to an airport tarmac that was laid down right around World War II. And we actually had Linus on last week, and he, you know, just looking at his stats, you know, first in Formula STCC Nordic, first in British Formula 3, which, as you know, that is tough to do because there's so much great talent in F3 over in the UK alone.
And the irony of the situation is, for Craig and I, when we began our first broadcast in Mid-Ohio, the story was the Indy Lights transplants. Yep. At the time, we had 3 drivers who made the move over in Malukas, Urrutia, and Frost for Andretti Autosport. Malukas and Urrutia were driving for HMD. And we said, you know, okay, now these guys are heavy hitters. They're competing for a scholarship for a series they already were scheduled to run in. Yeah. And for Urrutia, he's got a pretty impressive resume in Indy Lights already. So we had our eyes set on them, and then Linus just comes out in the wet and then the following day in the dry and just kind of shows everybody how it's done. I will say, you know, Malukas has been strong. He is living up to the expectations that we put on him with coming back and currently running second in the championship. He's got a number of podiums to boot. In fact, in the final race of the weekend for the Regional Americas at Barber, I mean, he kept it close. And I say close in terms of they pulled away from the rest of the field in excess of about 34 seconds. And I think when it came to the checkers, Malukas was only about 5 or 6 off, but he kept it under 2 seconds for the majority of the race until Lundqvist just started just hitting his marks and flying away. But, you know, when you look at the narrative of the series and how we present it to the public on Fan Racing, you know, we gave 3 powerhouse options, and that we also excluded Joshua Carr at that point, too. And it turned out that it was the kid from Sweden who's now just kind of showing everybody how to get the job done. And I guess a lot of that comes from the experience and success that he's had overseas, now bringing it here to the States with the Formula Regionals.
And it will be interesting to see if, A, he can run the table, B, continue the points lead in the championship, and C, if he does, there's another couple of other branches to think about, too. Will Indy Lights actually have a season next year? I hope so. And 2, will Roger Penske follow through on his suggestions of every IndyCar team has at least 1 Indy Lights car in there? Because if that's the case, we're going to be set up for some great racing throughout the whole ladder system, whether it be, you know, SCCA or the Road to Indy.
Yeah, and I think the elephant in the room when it comes to Indy Lights is, you know, the cost to compete and car count.
Yep.
And I mean, the form of the regionals, I mean, we did only have 13 cars this past week, and we started with about 17 Mid-Ohio, so you know, we're getting to a point in the season where I think that if the championship was the sole objective, drivers are starting to focus their racing ventures elsewhere. I want to see Indy Lights go back to what it was. You know, I'm trying to find like the heyday portion of it since the inception of this Indy Lights series in 2003. But I love the idea from Roger. I mean, and even if you look in some of the stock car series, there are some manufacturers that don't have that deep of a driver talent pool to pull from. I mean, Toyota's known for having a very long list in driver development. When you look at IndyCar, I mean, Andretti Autosport is obviously the one who kind of has their hands in everything as far as grooming the next driver who can step up to the top level. But I think if you kind of, I don't want to use the word mandate because it sounds too strict, but if you encourage these teams, maybe even give them some type of financial benefit to support that feeder series, which is meant to be just one step down from the top open wheel series in America, you're right. It's definitely going to fuel that series with the competitive nature it needs. And we mentioned some of the drivers already who, you know, Kyle Kirkwood, I was looking forward to watching what he could do this year with that Indy Lights opportunity. And I hope the plans are still in place for him to roll that on over into 2021, as you said, if it still happens. But they've got to pump some life into it in order to make it mean what it was meant to mean back in the day. And we've got the talent. I mean, it's worldwide. It's international pool. It's an international pool of talent. And that's something else I said on the broadcast. I mean, the Regional Americas has an international flair to it. If you kind of look at where some of these drivers are from, I mean, we mentioned that Lundqvist from Sweden, James Rowe from Ireland, and the list goes on and on. Formula 4 is starting to have a similar look to that as well. You know, and some may say, you know, well, the point of this is it's an American series. It should be meant to groom the next American champion. In fact, the Ligier chassis builder, Max Crawford, who I had a chance to talk to last week, we're going to have a long-form interview up on the website in the coming weeks. He said his personal goal, and keep in mind, Max, you know, started his racing career over in New Zealand. He didn't move to the States till he came, I think it was 1979 is when he transplanted to America. He said his goal with the work that he's putting into building these F4 and F3 chassis is to develop the next American Formula One driver, and in his eyes, Formula One champion. But even though that's their goal and that's their objective, the fact that we are generating international interest with these series kind of makes it a little bit more meaningful. Kind of means that if you could come in here and if you could beat this field, or if you could do what Linus is doing and dominate in what is, you know, no driver in the Formula Regional field is a slouch of any sorts. They've all got impressive resumes. They're all fast in their own right. But if you can come in here and do what he's doing, I mean, you're not just making a statement here in the States. You're making a statement around the world, and I love that element of it.
And that's one thing that Lena said is, you know, he looked at America because he saw the success that Marcus Ericsson was having, that Felix Rosenquist was having, and now he had money backers actually also look to come into the United States. So it's great to see that, you know, not only with the Nordic countries, but you're starting to see that with European flair. You're starting to see it with the Australians. You had Scott Dixon, then you had Will Power come over to race American Open Wheel. So drivers aren't just looking to Europe. Yes, there's still a lot of drivers over there, but you still have that American pull here with, you know, the great racing, whether it be an IndyCar or some of the other junior formulas. And frankly, I'm excited for the future. This is one heck. I mean, it's a shorter season, but it's going to be one heck of a season to kickstart the 20s. And hopefully will be the renaissance of open wheel in the 2000s.
And that's the conundrum in American open wheel racing, right? I mean, you work your way up through the system, you work your way up the ladder, and then, you know, oftentimes you hit this fork in the road. You know, do I stay here and try to squeeze my way into, you know, one of those limited opportunities in States, or maybe impress a sponsor enough to go straight to IndyCar, which we've seen a lot of drivers be able to do that, or drivers who paid their dues in lower series, maybe took some time off to work on the business side to garner up enough money to go take their shot at IndyCar. Or do I go to Europe and in some cases do it all over again? You know, I have to earn your keep here, take it over there, and then build your stock in Europe to give yourself a better opportunity at a longer career in the sport. And we're starting to bridge some of that gap. And in that interview I had with Max Crawford, it sounds like, you know, the F3 car may not be the end of the road for them as far as design and manufacturing. They've got some plans down the road, it sounds like. Not exactly sure what it's all going to entail. But some very exciting things may continue to come out of the Leger shop in the not-too-distant future. And again, we hope to have that up for everybody. We ran a short five-minute clip over the race broadcast this past week, and Max is just an incredible person, and he didn't do it alone. We mentioned the fact that we honor Andy Scriven every year at VIR. It was really Max and Andy who were burning the midnight oil to get these cars up into production where they could have up to 30-plus F4 cars on a weekend, and so far 17-plus form of the regional cars on a weekend. And they may not end there. And I think that, you know, as more interest is put on these series, even from an international perspective, it's only going to help the sport as a whole. And if we create another option or two for race teams and drivers and companies to extend their support in, it's only going to help the talent pool at the top of the level. We may start to wean out, and there's not that many left, to be honest. I mean, it's not like it was in the mid-2000s where you had, you know, journeyman businessmen who, you know, may not have had any business on the oval at Indianapolis, but they were still competing. We've kind of started to wean that crowd out with the additional international support, and this may be the chance to cement that from ever being a thing ever again.
Yeah, no longer are we hearing a pro club, quote unquote, just at IndyCar.
Exactly.
So that's the good news. All right, Eric Brennan, FanRacing.live, joins us. I want to talk about the upcoming schedule. We know of two races that are going to be happening for sure. The third, we're not sure where that's going to happen. Let's talk about Sebring. Got a month and a half until that race happens. I've got to say, you know, like I said, I've been there before. I know what kind of damage it does to cars. So it's going to be interesting to see how these drivers fare on the bumpy circuit.
One of my favorite events of the year, and I don't know why, and maybe this explains a lot about me and my racing personality, it's the IndyCar preseason test at Sebring.
Yes.
Because it's a track they don't run on. The results and the data they compiled there is probably not really that comparable as far as the undulating parts of the racetrack that, as you mentioned, is so rough on such an old and dilapidated surface in some places. But it really kind of shows, you know, who did their homework in the offseason as far as being fit and ready to compete. Who's got things dialed in on the mechanical front to be able to tackle a track that is as tough, as treacherous as the Sebring International Raceway? The sports cars proved just how physical of an endurance event it could be, not only when they run the 12 hours there, but also when some of the other touring series go there for some sprint races. And I think it is a great learning experience for these drivers and teams because it's an environment that is kind of like throwing it to the wolves. You know, it's not as tight and narrow and unforgiving as you would say like a street circuit, which thank goodness the F4 cars don't have any of those races on tap. However, with the surface being as rough as it is, with the track layout being as tough as it is, and I was joking with Craig Minervini because he actually lives in South Florida, and I said, you know, late September may not be too warm. It's still going to be hot.
Yeah.
That's been the theme of the year so far, as temperatures have been up everywhere we go in excess of 87 degrees. I think it was our low. We've been up over 95, I think, at VIR Mid-Ohio the entire weekend. This is a true test of physical fitness and concentration and focus, and I think Sebring is the best place to truly judge, and I'm actually looking forward to how Linus Lundqvist approach it, because I think this is his best test of the season, is how he tackles Sebring and how he's able to get his way through a track that is known to be rough, abrasive, and it's also the best test for the engineers and the teams that are working on these cars, because let's not forget, the drivers are not the only stories that we keep an eye on. I mean, yes, these race teams are purpose-built F4, FR race teams, some of them running both, some of them only one series, but a lot of the mechanics, a lot of the wrenchmen, a lot of the engineers, this is their proving grounds and their training grounds to work their way up. And I mean, sometimes you could just take pride in building a piece of machinery that could survive an elongated weekend at Sebring. So that's a little bit of a side piece that we try to keep an eye on as well, just as, especially as attrition starts to take a toll as we go out through some of these races. And I've never been to Sebring. It's going to be my first time, and I'm hyped. I can't wait.
And that next race is next weekend, I should say, is actually at the Homestead Miami Speedway. So they go from a bumpy track to basically a paper smooth track at Homestead.
Yeah, and if memory serves me correct, I don't remember the sports cars running there, at least not something that was on broadcast television until the mid-2000s. That was the last time that I remember seeing this layout in use in a top-tier form of motorsports. And they run Gustavo Yacomin as his academy, which, you know, they do a couple of things, and there's test sessions that happen at Homestead all the time. But as far as for me, being able to see some type of racing contest on this road course, I don't recall seeing something of this nature. And, you know, the word Roval is getting tossed about in the stock car world. In fact, IMSA is now going to the Charlotte Roval. They trademarked it at Charlotte with the Cup Series in October. And I really wish they would start to do that again a little bit more. I know they did it a lot back, as I mentioned, in the early 2000s. But for these types of race cars, the only time that I remember seeing any type of feeder series at Homestead was when the Light Series ran on the Oval. And we had thrilling racing. We saw some, you know, some frightening and terrifying accidents. So I like the fact that there's this road course that's in place. But you mentioned how smooth it is. I mean, even though, yeah, you know, they get a lot of rain down in South Florida, the oval portion of the track is worn out, but the infield portion of the track is very well maintained and well kept. And that's actually become a go-to venue as far as being able to break in a driver who's just learning an F4 car, even an FR car, because of how forgiving it can be. And it is also being all the way down there at the lowest portion of the country, I would say. It is a scenic sight when the sun starts to set on the back straightaway there. I've been over at the karting track cross street, been to Homestead a couple of times as well. And I think to go from Sebring to Homestead, again, just keeping that diverse nature in as far as getting these drivers ready for whatever may be next in their career, or just to, you know, try to improve on their season standings this year, it's a great add to the series. And I'm excited for that one as well. It's going to be a fun 2 weeks in Florida.
Yeah, I would love to get down to Homestead, mainly because I can get down to the Keys for a couple days. But actually, I did some research, too. The last time that layout was used in a professional setting was at least the 1998-1999 FIHET Championship.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a while.
Yeah. So
it's I just remember that Rolex sports car race where I believe it was Max Pappas.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I don't remember who the other car was. We're just slamming into each other on the front stretch in the oval.
Was it Pappas?
That's the one picture that comes to mind.
I can actually look that up. I used to know this at the top of my head because obviously I used to do Grand Am Unleashed with some friends. Actually, I'll find it later. But regardless, it's going to be interesting to see that because, yeah, it's going to be the first quote-unquote professional race in quite some time. I also remember, and this is an odd fact that I remember, the old Indy Lights series, when CART was sanctioning it, they would use Oval 1 and 2 and then use that other road course portion to go back. So they bypass 3 and 4 by using that road course portion.
That's unique. And that's one of those things where, like, if I have any downtime, which I'm sure you can relate to this too, Jeremy, has been limited nowadays, which is a good thing because that means that we're back in motion. But usually I like to scour, you know, YouTube and just see if I could find any footage of stuff. I usually try to head up my production team with any type of television broadcast that was done at some of these events to give them an idea of the look that the average viewer may be, you know, accustomed with. Sebring has that element. Circuit of the Americas has that element. Homestead is going to be an entirely different animal. But, I mean, being the fact they host the annual stock car race there, there will be some opportunities and options up way up top to be able to catch a lot of the track. But I'm excited to see how we laid things out and are able to cover that one because it's a unique layout. And I think it's going to gain a lot of interest from a lot of different people. And, you know, Homestead's one of the names that we hear, you know, fans say they want the IndyCar series to go back to. I mean, I know there's a increased demand in terms of wanting competitive ovals and safe ovals. And with as wide as Homestead could be, I think it's fair to say that that is one of the options. But if they're looking to try to get down to that market down in that part of the country, I know we already go to St. Pete on an annual basis, but, you know, if this thing works and it provides a good enough platform, I mean, who knows? You know, we may not ever see IndyCar there, but some of the other, you know, Road to Indy series may have a chance to exercise this track layout as well if they ever want to travel that far down south.
Yeah, because I can't remember. I can't remember if they use, because I know they do some spring training there, the Road to Indy. I'm not 100% sure if they use the road course itself or if they use the roval portion. Anyway, run a little bit long, so I want to talk real quick about the quote-unquote scheduled COTA race. Now, a couple weeks ago, the U.S. Grand Prix canceled. Where does that leave F4 right now? Is COTA still on, or are there other options being looked at?
So from what I gathered this weekend in the paddock, it sounded as though, because I was with everybody else, I've been hearing everything that I think we all have, is that, you know, Circuit of the Americas was in trouble. You know, obviously the IndyCar race got scrapped there for the year, and then the Formula One race gets nixed when they can't come over to this side of the world anywhere. They're not going to race here, Canada, or Mexico. So I thought that was the nail in the coffin for the weekend. It sounds like the SCCA, as of now, and granted, I mean, we're talking October 23rd, 24th, 25th, so a lot could happen between now and then. Sounds like the SCCA has taken control of that weekend, and they really want to put this show on at Circuit of the Americas. Obviously, it's not going to be supported by the Formula One Series since they won't be there, but that means that they will have control of the track time. They will have control of the schedule. From what I understand, there are some rumblings that they may tack on another club series or so to kind of support the weekend and, you know, add a little bit more interest to the overall appeal of the racing action to wrap up our championship. But there is a lot of anticipation and hope that we do, in fact, get to COTA. And I know for the drivers, it means a lot to actually compete on a track where a lot of their heroes and current stars, you know, are able to race and hone their skills on. And it is an absolutely state-of-the-art, beautiful facility. I've never been there before, so I was selfishly hoping that they find a way to pull it off. But I thought it was a less than 10% chance once F1 officially pulled the plug. And it sounds like they are finding a way to make it happen. And I think the timing of this race is also imperative, because you mentioned back-to-back races in Florida. And then, of course, you got the, you know, the 10-plus hour drive out west to get to Texas. I think the teams really do need a couple of races in between, because Florida seems to be a certainty as far as being able to get races in, and I don't know if they wanted to be able to try to keep everyone down there for that long. So as of right now, the plan is stick with COTA to wrap up our season.
All right, Eric, we'll get you back on shortly. Eric Brennan from fanracing.live, thanks for joining us. Hopefully you learned a little bit more today.
I really appreciate it, Jeremy. Thank you for all that you're doing for the sport and also for helping get the word out. And again, for the fans who haven't heard, it's fanracing.live. For the rest of this season and maybe even further down the road, the live stream is free. All you got to do is throw your email in and you can watch every race of the F4 and FR American Championships powered by Honda for free. And I tip my cap to everybody who makes it possible. We got a great team to put on a great show and truly make it feel like that you're watching it on a top-tier level racing network. And I'm just lucky to be a part of it.
All right, Eric, we'll chat with you after Florida. Eric Brennan, fanracing.live. Coming up next on Inside Open Wheel, we're going to sit down and chat about, well, it's going to be the potpourri. So potpourri without Celebrity Jeopardy. That's next on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel with Jeremy Scott.
Well, as I've been previewing all day long, we're going to have news from Jimmy Johnson's IMS test. I got the one thing that no other podcast has because I do certain things on my phone. Other than that, we've got IndyCar analyst Nick Yeoman with us. And I've got to say, Nick, I'm bummed we're not going to Mid-Ohio for a double, as we talked about with Mike Shank last week.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, it's boy, it's just the story of this summer and the spring and the 2020 NTT IndyCar season. It's just everything's fluid, everything's changing, and every week it seems like there's new news. And as excited as I think a lot of folks got when it was announced that the one of the West Coast races would be going to Mid-Ohio, so for folks that were going to make their way out to Lexington to get to see two IndyCar races, was going to be quite the treat. But then the news came down that, after consulting with the health officials, that the race is going to be postponed. So it's a bummer. I've really grown to love going out to that racetrack, that campground feel. It's a vintage racetrack. It's a little rustic. It's, you know, you're never going to be blown away by the facilities, but when the fans pack that place and it has a feel to it, it makes for a cool race weekend. So yeah, it is a big bummer. And I know a lot of race car drivers, a lot of the IndyCar drivers that really enjoy going to Mid-Ohio are just as bummed, because usually, especially in the last couple years with this Universal Aero kit, it's put on some good racing.
You mean the one driver named Scott Dixon leading the points?
He's the one for sure.
I mean, it is a bummer because, you know, you got that. You have, As I said, Mike Shank, who he is homes there a lot of, and it's a home road course race. Let's just be honest here, because it's so close to Indianapolis for a lot of teams that it's a home game for them. It's not, you know, yeah, you've got the road course to Indianapolis, but now you may be going in September, October, or not at all. Nobody knows at this point. And there's another racetrack I want to talk about that really kind of worries me about it not happening, but let's stay in Mid-Ohio. September, October, I've been down there around that time, and it's a little chilly, and I think that that may even put on a better race, because you're going to have that nip in the air early in the morning, and that's going to lead to cooler temperatures throughout the day.
Yeah, honestly, I'm super hopeful because, as you know, growing up in, you know, in the Midwest here, you know, sometimes the fall can be quite nice. So, you know, if it's nice light jacket or sweatshirt weather, I think that can make for a fun experience, because, you know, in the past we've gone there and there's been some weekends where it's pretty hot. So there's certainly the potential for it to be a nice, cool, brisk weekend. But, you know, you mentioned Michael Shank, and of course there's drivers throughout the paddock too. Graham Rahal. He's had such a popular win there a few years ago. Zach Veach, this is kind of the home race for him, being an Ohio native as well. So keeping those fingers crossed, but you're right. I mean, I had a couple people ask me this week as soon as the news came down, like, what do you think the date's going to be? Do you think they'll go to a different track? And, you know, I just hate to say it, but I just don't know. I would hate to be in the position of the decision makers for IndyCar of trying to make this all work. But, boy, it's just every week it's something, and we're all just trying to figure out and you know, piece together what might be left for the schedule.
Yeah, Roger Penske and Mark Miles, they've been really handed a big onion this year, and they're making the best out of a good, bad situation. Another thing I thought of, too, that's Honda North America's home race.
Exactly.
It's going to happen one way or another, whether or not it's fans or whether or not it happens at all. That's all left to be seen. You can't, and here's the thing, you cannot fault Governor Mike DeWine. He's doing the best he can to keep his residents safe. And yeah, it sucks, but at the same time, we've got to stop and figure. We're darn lucky we're getting racing at all this year.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't profess to be a health expert. I try to trust those that have, you know, gone to the schooling and have been studying this stuff for many, many years. So, you know, anyone that's an IndyCar diehard fan, I know they get upset about this and the conspiracy theories start flying around. But man, you just got to trust the folks in charge that are studying this stuff and that they know what's best. So, but you mentioned Honda, and certainly I feel for the promoters too, the mm-hmm. folks from Green Savory, who obviously had their first race of the season disrupted with St. Petersburg. We're hopeful we'll be able to close out the season there down in Florida. They have the race up in Toronto that got canceled, and then obviously the one here at Mid-Ohio. And then, of course, they were supposed to promote the Portland race as well, which got canceled. So, man, tough. It's just tough for everybody right now, and we're just hopeful. But the nice thing is when you look at the calendar, the schedule for IndyCar, there's a big gap in September. And hopefully they can find a weekend that works for Mid-Ohio, for the IndyCar Series drivers, the teams, and everyone involved, NBC on the TV side, and hopefully we can make something work.
And another weekend I'm really, really worried about right now is Worldwide Technology Raceway. You know, here in Illinois, Nick, that we've been having nothing but issues with COVID-19, most of it obviously from the Chicagoland area, but now we're starting to see the East Metro of St. Louis bloom a little bit. And it was somebody who actually does stuff in the St. Louis metro area. I've been kind of keeping my eye on that. I'm hoping that the Worldwide Technology Raceway does not need to cancel. However, if they do, there's a nice speedway about 2-3 hours to the north. I mean, it may not be run with fans, but it's a fan favorite.
Yeah, I know. I would love to see. I know some people tossed around some of these ovals that IndyCar went to in yesteryear, maybe to fill in the gaps. But, you know, you mentioned, you know, Worldwide Technology Raceway, and I would hope in the last couple of years they've had a massive sellout crowd, but they also haven't opened up that massive turn one and turn two grandstands. So I'm hopeful that even if, you know, the numbers continue to rise and that COVID still looks like it's an issue a month from now, I'm hopeful that maybe we can still run the race with spreading people out. But you're right. When it comes to, you know, governments making decisions and consulting with local health officials and epidemiologists, all of a sudden race promoters and those of us just trying to go see a race kind of goes to the wayside. So I'm with you, man. I mean, my fingers are just, they are perpetually crossed because I'm just hoping for the best. And hopefully we can go racing down there in St. Louis because it's been fantastic the last couple of years. Put on some pretty good races, and to have a doubleheader, two races, I think it'll be a good show. But again, everyone crossing their fingers.
Using that fancy Ball State Education, St. Epidemiologist. Wow, I'm amazed. That's fantastic.
Don't ask me to spell it. I can say it, but I cannot spell it.
I feel the same way. But okay, so yeah, so coming up now on the Indianapolis 500. Still don't know if we're going to hit 33, but as we know, Roger Penske, I wouldn't be surprised if we hit 33 at the last minute.
No, I won't either. I mean, they'll find a way to get 33 cars. Yeah.
Yeah, so obviously all the full-time cars. We know that Dryan Reinbold's going to have two with Sage Karam and J.R. Hildebrand. Any others that I'm missing right now?
I mean, I guess there's some talk about, you know, Dale Coyne and James Davison's ride, possibly where that, you know, cycles out. But, I think we'll get to 33. But I will say this, even if we don't, like if there's ever a year where we can all sit back and say, you know what, if there's 31 or 32 cars for the Indy 500, it's not going to ruin the race. This would be the year, right? I mean, I know that there are diehards that are so passionate about this stuff, and I get it. But if there was ever going to be a year where we come up short and no one really minds because there's a bigger picture here of, hey, let's just get a 500-mile race in, this would be it. But off the top of my head, no, I'd have to look at the roster and the teams and look at exactly who may still field a car.
Yeah, I've heard rumblings about the Davison ride. I know Pippa Mann came out and said she's not going to run because she couldn't get the sponsorship, you know, which is a shame because it's one less car. But yeah, if we don't get 33, I won't be too heartbroken. Just as long as we get a race, I think I'll be pretty happy. All right, last week, one of the big news before the Mid-Ohio reschedule, Cole Pearn, NASCAR Cup Series Championship Crew Chief, was announced that he's going to be on the stand for Connor Daly. I love the move. That is a fantastic move by Ed Carpenter.
Yeah, I do too. And I'll be honest with you, I don't really know of Cole's, you know, significant background outside of what he's done in NASCAR. I don't know if he has a lot of open wheel racing. If you know, let me know. But it's a huge get. I mean, he's been very successful. A guy that helped that Furniture Row team, that small team that was, you know, racing out of Denver, Colorado for so many years. Reached the upper echelon and win a championship with Martin Truex Jr. just a couple years ago. So a smart guy out of retirement and now gets to work with a guy in Connor Daly who's really fast, and Ed Carpenter Racing, who we know is going to be a threat for the pole. Will they have that race strategy and the pace throughout the course of 500 miles? Haven't exactly showed that over the past decade, but we know those cars are good, and we know Connor's pretty good. He showed last year driving for Andretti Autosport that if you put a good car underneath Connor Daly, the Indiana Hoosier, he'll go out there and put together a good effort. So I think it's a great pairing, and I'm fascinated to hear from Cole and find out exactly what he thinks of being in the IndyCar paddock.
So quick search of Cole Pearn. He actually started out as a CASCAR driver, which is now the NASCAR Pinty Series, which we've seen, you know, Andrew Ranger and Alex Tagliani in. And then he went as a crew chief after he graduated college, but his best finish looks like it was a sixth place at Delaware Speedway and Race City Speedway, obviously north of the border. So CASCAR has always been a great series. It's actually one of my favorite stock car series when Speed would have it on. I would make sure to watch it every week.
Yeah, no, they always race at Toronto. Yep. We're up there, and they always put on a pretty good fantastic show. So not a lot of open wheel experience for him, but if he's as smart of an engineer as it seems like, I think he'll probably figure it out. And again, he's got some really good folks to bounce ideas off of and information off of from Ed Carpenter Racing because of the feel that they have for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So to have him there, you know, kind of calling the strategy and looking after Connor Daly's effort, I think it's going to be fun. I think it's going to be one of the cooler storylines of the month. Well, I almost said the month of May, the month of August.
I've stopped myself from saying that all the past couple months. Actually, I did some background research too, and this stumbled across my radar. Did you know that in 2002, Richard Childress was the race strategist for Robbie Gordon in the 500?
I did not know that he was the strategist. I knew that he was like involved a little more hands-on with that effort, but no, that's a pretty cool stat, because I think Robbie ran pretty good in that race as well.
Finished eighth after a lap 80 pit fire. And another interesting stat, he approached the thrill from West Hill about running in NASCAR, because at that time it was uncertain if CART was going to continue. As we know, it continued on until 2007. But Childress making moves in 2002 at the 500.
To come full circle, how about the news that Paul Tracy and Tony Kanaan are both signed up, ready to go with this brand new Tony Stewart All-Star Stock Car Series? I'm not exactly sure what it's going to look like, but how great is that? That's going
to
be fun.
I'm excited to see that. That's going to be a lot of fun to see who else they can get. I heard somebody suggest that maybe Jimmy Johnson should try the SRX on the side. And anytime you can get Tony Stewart and Ray Everett Ham all together. That's going to be a fun series. Speaking of Jimmy Johnson, I got times from today, from the test last week, and you know as well as I do how hard those are to get.
Oh, yeah, they don't release a lot of that information. They like to keep that under wraps.
Oh, well, you know what? Someone should have warned Jimmy Johnson not to start his Strava, I'll say that. For those who don't know, Strava is basically a data app that runners, bike riders use to see, you know, how they're doing in their training. I use it just to, you know, log my rides and see, you know, where I'm at in different segments. So the other day I was scrolling through Strava. I follow Jimmy Johnson, and all of a sudden I see what looks like the IMS road course. I'm like, click on it. And there's different segments on there. One of those segments is a full lap of the Indy GP course. Well, he didn't run many laps. I heard from sources that he ran about 110 laps around the full circuit, and his best lap, Nick, was a 71-second lap. And really, for someone who's never been in an Indy car, that's not half bad.
I was going to say, I want to say lap times this past month, they in like the 108s, 107s range?
Yep, during qualifying. I didn't see what the race lap was. Let me pull that up real quick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, and I heard Scott Dixon, I think he tweeted out, and I think he was quoted as saying is, yeah, he's not far off. I mean, he could pick it up pretty quickly, and that wouldn't surprise me at all. Jimmy Johnson's incredibly talented, and I think, you know, you give a guy of that skill level the amount of time to run a car, and he's going to figure it out. So, no, it's cool, and that's some good sleuth work by you, Jeremy. I'm awful impressed, but I'm hopeful maybe at the end of the season with that that Harvest Grand Prix. I know that's a Friday-Saturday event, and then NASCAR runs at Talladega on Sunday, and if the rules don't change where those guys aren't qualifying right or practicing in the Cup Series, there may be an opportunity to get Jimmy in a car, so that's going to be interesting.
I just pulled up the box score from that from the GMR Grand Prix. Scott Dixon ran a 71.7 during the race. So
that's race pace.
Yeah, that's race pace. So
it's not bad. So he's right there. He's knocking on the door.
No. So yeah, I hope that we see Jimmy Johnson at the Harvest Grand Prix. But at the same time, maybe I would rather see him get a test or two at Sebring and then do a road course season. Maybe with Ed Carpenter Racing, keep that Chevy ties together. You know, who knows? It's going to be an interesting silly season, I think, especially with, you know, maybe Hinchcliffe does well at the 500 and does, you know, was able to get into a seat. Maybe Will Power does leave Penske. I don't see that happening. But the big story, though, I think we're going to have to watch what happens to the Penske IMSA drivers now that they've been told that they can go elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, especially because Elio Castroneves, I do not think wanted to leave IndyCar by any means, no, and was kind of, you know, given this option by Roger Penske of, hey, it's either you could drive the sports car or you could be released from your contract. I don't know if Juan Montoya necessarily wants to get back behind the wheel of an IndyCar. I mean, Juan kind of does what Juan wants to do, but Elio's the one that I'm watching because we know he's still very, very passionate. He wants to go for a fourth Indianapolis 500, so with those guys now all of a sudden kind of out of work and looking around, those are going to be at least one of those names going to be very interesting to watch throughout the offseason.
Here's one that we can throw out of left field. Does Roger Penske put Ricky Taylor into a seat to test him to give the IndyCar team owners a chance to see what he can do?
I think it'd be cool. I'd love to see Ricky Taylor in anything that Roger Penske has, whether it be an Indy car, an open wheel car, which I know is probably more his interest, or I'd just love to see him in a stock car too. I mean, driving something, that guy is just so incredibly talented. So there are going to be options out there for him. I would like to see it remain with Roger Penske and maybe an opportunity to drive an Indy car.
Yeah, the Taylor brothers are just fantastic. Fantastic people and fantastic talent. Nick, thanks for joining us. We'll definitely chat around the 500. I've got to get Mark Janes on. So hopefully after the show after qualifying, we'll sit down, have a nice long discussion, talk about the 500 and all things IndyCar.
Yeah, I hope we can make that work, man, for sure.
And that does it for Inside Open Wheel. I'm Jeremy Scott. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.